the second part of the first purport, invocation purport. So the second part talks about how the material world is perfect. When we say that the material world is perfect, this can lead to naturally the design argument that we can talk about. The design argument, we say that this world is perfectly designed. So, if you look at this world around us, there is certainly complexity in this world. Whether we look at the construction of our own bodies, whether we look at the construction of microscopic cells, or even the patterns that we see in nature. So now, in general, there is no denying of the complexity. So the design argument has two parts. The first part of the design argument is that the design argument basically is some succinct way of saying that the world is designed and the design comes from God. That's called the design argument. This is what we use in Discover Yourself Session 1, normally speaking. So, what is undeniable in this world is that there is complexity. Now, where does the complexity come from? The complexity can come either from natural factors, or it can come from some not natural in the sense of intelligent factors. See, a natural, the opposite of that is not supernatural. It is intelligent when we talk in terms of what we see in the world. A simple example is that if an investigator comes to a crime scene and finds that a knife has penetrated the victim's stomach and that has caused a fatal wound and the death of the victim. So now, by looking at the way the knife has, say, penetrated the stomach, the investigator can try to make out whether that knife's penetration was a natural event, in the sense that maybe the knife slipped and fell on his stomach, or he slipped and fell on the knife, or it was intentional penetration, intelligently done by someone who wanted to kill him. So whether this particular knife wound has a natural cause, or it is not supernatural, it is intelligent cause. Intelligent means there is a person who has caused it. So when we look at the design in the world, there is this issue whether the design came naturally, as evolutionists would have us believe, or it required an intelligent cause, which in turn would lead to the idea of God. So traditionally, the design argument has never been used much in Indian philosophy, because the existence of God was not much an issue of debate. Unless, of course, Buddhism and Jainism came about, and they were, from the historical point of view, reactionary religions which reacted to the caste discrimination within Hinduism. So, since their time onwards, many Indian philosophers also started using the design argument. And in the Western philosophy, the design argument was used especially in the face of ascent of the empirical or the scientific approach in the 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th centuries. So the idea was that this world is so complicated, therefore there must be a designer for it, and that designer is God. And right from people like Newton, all the pioneers of science, of modern science, they all practically talked about God as the designer of the world. Like in my book, Science and Spirituality, I give a list of around 25 scientists, prominent, they're founders of their particular fields, which are all foundational to modern science now. So they have all talked about their belief in God. But over a period of time, the 19th, 20th century came up, this argument came under increasing criticism. So there are two sources of criticism One is scientific and the other is philosophical. So we will not go too much into scientific argument. The scientific argument was this design can come by natural patterns like evolution. And there is a strong evidence that contradicts it. Now, evolution is probably the only theory in science which is widely believed by scientists and widely disbelieved by everyone else. Scientists believe it. It's not that all scientists believe it, but many scientists believe it. And practically everybody else disbelieves it. So there is a lot of strong evidence against that theory. But we will look primarily at the philosophical argument here. So the philosophical argument is that there is so much suffering in the world. There is so much deficiency in this world. If rains come from God, then sometimes there are floods, and sometimes there are famine, sometimes there is shortage. So this world does not seem to be perfectly designed, in the sense that there is so much suffering in the world. So the primary philosophical argument against the design argument is that there is so much suffering in the world. And of course, we can answer this in terms of the law of karma. But then that is proposing another theory which is not yet proven. So it is like building theory upon theory to explain the evidence. But a simpler way to explain this is to understand that all designs are linked with purposes. And if we look at the design without considering the purpose, we can find fault with any design, even the best design. A simple example is, if I use a cell phone, a mobile, it is primarily designed for the purpose of communication through sound. Occasionally, we can communicate by typing and sending SMS. But if I start trying to use a cell phone for writing a book, and then start complaining, what a stupid design, it's so difficult to type over here. It's not the design that is stupid, the purpose that I am putting it to use is wrong. So design has to always be evaluated within the context of the purpose. And if we forget the purpose, then any design can be faulted. So, what is the purpose of the world? If we consider that the design of this world is for the purpose of our enjoyment, then we can easily fault the design. We can say that if I am designed, my body is designed by God, then I can see that there are so many talents and abilities that I lack. Maybe I don't look good enough, maybe I can't do this well enough. And if this world is meant for enjoyment, there are so many resources that are lacking. So, at this morning I was talking about romanticizing the world, thinking that this world is a place for enjoyment. So at the karmakanda level, the idea is that this world is a place for enjoyment. And at an operational level, most of the Semitic religions means Judaism, Christianity and Islam. They all came in the same geographical area they originated. That's why they are called Semitic religions, or they are called as Abrahamic religions. Because one of their founding prophets is Abraham, for all of them, common. So in the Abrahamic religions, at an operational level, they perform at the level of karmakanda. You do good and then you will get good. You do bad and you will get bad. Now, they promise good in this world and they also promise good in the next world. But if you look at what is the good that they promise in the next world, it is largely materialistic. We'll get to enjoy, for example, in Islam, these jihadis get the promise that we'll get so many, 73 virgin girls to enjoy with for the rest of eternity. So that is what prompts these people. They saying, I don't get one girl to enjoy in this life. So what is the loss? Let me just do this. Let me lay down my life and I will enjoy. So what is happening is, there is the Western culture promotes this worldly materialism. And Islamic culture promotes otherworldly materialism. But it is essentially materialism. And why it is materialism? Because the conception of life and the conception of enjoyment is materialistic. So even when they talk about the next life, they talk about enjoyment in materialistic terms. there'll be this to drink, there'll be this to eat, and there'll be this ways to enjoy, and things like that. So, when the foundational platform is enjoyment, and that too material enjoyment, then the examination of this world as an arena of enjoyment always leads to a dissatisfactory finding. We'll always find that there's not enough in this world for enjoyment. So the design argument was, throughout history it has been criticized for the point of the presence of evil and the presence of suffering in this world. Why will a good God allow suffering? And the Abrahamic religions are quite poor in their answer to this question. Especially because they don't bring in karma and they don't accept karma and reincarnation. So it becomes very difficult to answer that. But the point is that this world is a place for our enjoyment is a wrong assumption. So we are evaluating the design from a wrong purpose point of view. So let's look at the world now. We see two undeniable features in this world. One is we see complexity. And complexity that would normally require design. And secondly, we see suffering. Neither of these can be denied in this world. So now, are there any places in this world where these two coexist? And that would be a good model for an understanding what is the purpose of this world. Is there any place where design and suffering coexist? So, yeah, one is a hospital, another is a jail. So, earlier in the morning I was talking about using different analogies for different purposes. So, the jail analogy conveys the point that we have done something wrong. In a jail, things are well designed. You know, at this time this will happen, at that time that will happen. And the prisoners in the jail also have their quarters, whatever, they have their small place to stay. And they have well-defined work to do. So it's designed, but there is suffering also in that. And similarly, in hospitals, everything is well-designed. You know, okay, this time you have to do this, this time you have to do this, this time this doctor will come, this time this nurse will come, and then this is how this surgery is to be performed, this is how this treatment is to be done. But along with that, there is suffering also. So these two places where we see both design and suffering together. So the jail analogy conveys the point that we have done something wrong. And that's why we are suffering. But the jail analogy fails to convey the point that God is not the cause of our suffering. The jail analogy, if God is the jailer, then he is sort of, if he's not causing our suffering, he's at least ensuring our suffering. He's making sure that our suffering happens, comes upon us. But the hospital analogy conveys the point that yes, we are suffering, but God is not the cause of our suffering. God is helping us to cure our suffering. So this world, if we have to understand its design, we have to understand it with also its purpose. So its purpose is twofold. Purpose is experimentation and rectification. Experimentation and rectification. So, these two analogies which we just now discussed, the hospital and the jail, both talk about rectification from different focus, foci. Foci is the plural of focus. So, rectification in terms of we changing our free will is conveyed through the jail analogy. And rectification in terms of God helping us to make the change is conveyed through the hospital. Now, for the point of experimentation, there are different analogies given. One is that a child may want to imitate the parent and do what the parent is doing. So the small baby, a little girl sees that the mother is cooking. And then the little girl, instead of assisting the mother in cooking, she says, I want to cook. And now she is so small, she can't cook on her own. So the mother, she gives her a toy set, a toy cooking set. A toy stove, toy utensils, and the child, little girl gets busy in cooking. And she's busy in cooking, and she cooks very busily, but when it comes time to eat, when she starts feeling hungry, there is no food. So, then she has to run back to her mother and ask for food. So, when we want to imitate Krishna, Krishna is the supreme enjoyer. and he gives us a replica where we can play around with. But when we find that this doesn't give me happiness, Krishna says, this is what you want to try out? Try it out. When it doesn't give me happiness, let me turn back and turn towards Krishna. So, this is the idea of experimentation. Now, according to philosophers, the evil in this world is twofold. One is natural evil and the other is moral evil. Natural evil means that and these often lead to mass suffering. So, natural evil, we understand from within our philosophical point of view that it is a reaction to karma, karmic reaction. But beyond that also, it is a part of Krishna. This will come later, and Srila Prabhupada talks in one purport that the miseries of material existence indirectly serve us to remind us of our incompatibility with matter. The miseries of material existence indirectly serve to remind us of our incompatibility with matter. We don't belong here. So moral evil means, natural evil is meant to help us understand this is not the world we belong to. Moral evil means we tend to do wrong things and people tend to do wrong things. It is not just that earthquakes and tsunamis occur. There are people who are serial killers, there are people who are rapists, there are people who are extortionists. So why do people do wrong things? If God has made people, then why do people act in evil ways? If God has designed us, then why do we have a tendency towards evil? So, to understand this answer, we have to understand this world is also like a school. It is a place for education. And when we are in a school, if we see in this world, there is so much allurement that is there. Allurement means temptation to do wrong. And it seems that God creates the good-looking sense objects and God gives us senses that attract us to sense objects and then God tells us don't enjoy. You know, why would God do something like this? Isn't it something which is like a torture? So the point is that this world is like a place for education. And it's not that God doesn't want us to enjoy, but God wants us to have the best possible enjoyment for us. So when a teacher teaches a subject and then has an exam in which there is a multiple choice paper. In the multiple choice paper, there are 5 options. The teacher only gives 5 wrong answers. And if we go by probability, there is 80% probability that the student will get answers wrong. And at the end, just if the student is going by chance, he'll only get 20% mark and he will fail. And if the student at the end of the exam tells, you know, the teacher, you caused my failure because you put all those wrong options there. So the teacher will say, yes, I may have put the wrong options, but you ticked them. I didn't tick them for you. So now the teacher could be blamed if the teacher had not given any education. If the teacher has given education, then the wrong alternatives serve to test the understanding and learning of the student. So, in this world, Krishna gives us multiple options of what we want to do. And these multiple options are meant not by Krishna to make us go on the wrong track, but they are given to help us choose the right answer, to help us choose the right way to happiness. So, the moral evil, that means say, people succumb to lust, anger, greed, envy, pride and illusion. Is that because Krishna wants them to succumb? No, Krishna wants them to come back to Him. But if they choose wrong, then they are responsible. So just as when they choose, then the student takes the right alternative, who gets marks. Similarly, every time we make a right choice, we make spiritual advancement. We go closer to Krishna, we go closer to real happiness. So, without the test, there is no way to evaluate the learning. So whether we have internalized Krishna's message and whether we have solidified our commitment to choose Krishna, that is evaluated through the temptations. The temptations are not there to mislead us, but they are there to compel us to take seriously our free will and to make the right choice. So in that sense, the material world serves its purpose. So what are the purposes? Experimentation and rectification. So for experimentation, I gave two examples. First example of a child imitating the mother. The second is a teacher evaluating the students. The teacher gives multiple options. So Krishna gives multiple options for us to check out. What is it that is going to make you happy? Do you think this is going to make, fame is going to make you happy? Sex is going to make you happy? Power is going to make you happy? Try it out. So all these are like alternatives Krishna gives us. And Krishna tells us through scriptures, through Guru Sadhu Shastra, even through the voice of our own conscience, as the super soul in our heart, what is the right choice. And if we don't choose that right choice, then it is we who suffer. So in this way, if we evaluate the design of the world from its purpose point of view, then it is complete, as Srila Prabhupada says. So it serves its purpose. I will discuss more about the design of the world when Srila Prabhupada discusses about it in the purport at a later stage. Are there any questions about this now? Yes.
He asked that Krishna created Jiva, that Jiva cannot enjoy independently of Krishna. But if Krishna is God, he can create Jivas who can enjoy independently of Krishna. So why he didn't create us like that? Why he created in such a way that ultimately we'll come back to him? We have to come there. He has not kept any option for us.
Good question. This was the precise point I was going to answer later. I'll answer now. See, when we talk about enjoyment, often we have again a materialistic idea of enjoyment. That means, you know, everybody can have lots of sense gratification, everybody can have lots of sensory capacity for sense gratification. Now all that is there in heaven, and still people are not happy over there. The real happiness comes through love. And for real happiness to come through love, there has to be an object worthy of love. We can offer compassion to somebody who's unworthy of love also. But that is a sort of extending of our heart. That is not really reciprocation. You know, if you want to love somebody, if there is a deformed beggar on the street, you cannot have a loving relationship. You can show compassion on that person. If you really want to love and have a satisfying relationship, we need an object worthy of love. So all of us as souls in the spiritual world have already experienced the joy of loving Krishna. Krishna is a supremely attractive person with the six opulences. And after having loved him, we cannot be satisfied by loving anyone else. Because he is so supremely attractive that nobody else can substitute for him. So if Krishna is to create a material world where we can be happy separate from him, then not only has to create a material world, but he has to create a substitute or a duplicate of himself. Some other person who is having all the six opulences, and we can love him and we can be happy by loving him. But then if somebody else has six opulences, then that person will become the center of attraction. And then that will become another spiritual world, because that person will be the center of attraction and enjoyment. So, in principle, there cannot be any substitute to the Supreme. In principle, there cannot be any substitute to the Supreme. So, therefore, it is not an inadequacy or deficiency of Krishna that he does not create a world where we can enjoy. Because what will enjoyment require? Enjoyment will require us having a satisfactory object of love. And a satisfactory object of love has to be equivalent to him. And if there is an object equivalent to him, that becomes another spiritual world. So then where is our capacity to enjoy separately? So then still Krishna respects our free will. Krishna never intrudes on or takes away our free will. So what does he do? We can be supremely happy by loving him. But to love him, it is we who have to use our free will properly. Now if we desire to use our free will improperly, then what does Krishna do? Krishna creates a world where we can try to enjoy separate from him. And if we look at the world the way he has created it, he could have created this world as a constant place of suffering. If there had been only suffering in this world, what would have happened? we would have got used to it. Just like, you know, if a person is not having eyes, then when he is walking along the street, maybe using a stick or something like that, we may feel pity on him. But over a period of time, the people who are blind, they get used to it. And if they remember they are blind, that is because people around them are not blind. If there were a kingdom where everybody was blind, nobody would feel bad that they are blind. Because everybody, that would be the normal way of living. So if this world were just a constant place of suffering, we would have got used to that suffering. Now, so what are the alternatives that are there? See, can Krishna, if this were a place of constant enjoyment, Krishna would have had to create another Krishna. And that would have defeated our purpose. If this were a place of constant suffering, then there would be no hope of reformation, because you just get used to it. We'll get deadened by all that suffering and we'll just get used to it. So Krishna creates this world in a way that there is a lot of suffering that reminds us that that we are incompatible. But along with that, there are glimpses of pleasure. There are glimpses of pleasure which make us hanker for pleasure. And Prabhupada writes in the purport of 3.37 that after 3.37 is the start of the last section. Arjuna is asking, what makes people do wrong things? And Prabhupada's explanation was very beautiful. He says in the answer, Kamesha Krodesha purport, that the soul, after prolonged search for happiness in this world, the soul gets baffled. And when he gets baffled, then he starts searching, where is real happiness? So if Krishna had kept no happiness in this world, we would have just got used to living without happiness. By creating a world with glimpses of happiness, when we start striving, and we find when there is no happiness, then we start inquiring, where is there happiness? So, in the second Rath Yatra that was held in America in 1969, Srila Prabhupada gave a brilliant lecture. His predominant audience was hippies. So, Srila Prabhupada says, I know all of you hippies are not very much appreciated in America, because people say that you are frustrated. But human life is meant to be frustrated. Human life is meant to be frustrated. Because only when we are frustrated with material life will we start inquiring about spiritual life. And that is the purpose of human life. Tato Brahma Jigyasa. So normally we say we should inquire about spirituality. But when will we inquire about spirituality? When we are frustrated with material life. So, this is probably no Acharya has given this explanation of Brahma Jigyasa. You know, that frustration with material life leads one to spiritual life. Now, there's a significant difference over here. You know, some people can be frustrated with the failures of material life. Some people can be frustrated with the successes of material life. Some people can be frustrated with the successes of material life. The Karmakanda path gives us success in material life and shows us the futility of that success. Dharma, Artha and Kaam, if a person keeps enjoying again and again and again, then at one particular time a person comes with the, is that all that there is to life? Isn't there something more to life? A person can have a lot of wealth, lot of power, lot of sense gratification, but is that all? And when the person asks the question, is that all? At that time the meaning of just, no, there is more to life. But many people, especially in modern times, see how traditional Vedic culture would go. Let's say a man gets married to a woman. Then the mind has a, Prabhupada writes in the 18th chapter purport, that the purpose of marriage is to make the mind peaceful so that one can practice spiritual life. So how does marriage make the mind peaceful? If the mind has a lot of fantasies about, I can get so much sense gratification and enjoyment through that. So okay, the soul is allowed a facility to get married and to try out the hopes for enjoyment. And the soul tries it out, if I find this doesn't give me enjoyment. Then the soul understands, okay, this is not going to make me happy. Where will I get happiness? And he turns elsewhere. But in modern society, because there is so much sexual bombardment, so what happens is, even when a person has sex and finds that I don't get happiness, he thinks that maybe with this particular person when I do sex, I don't get happiness. If I do with somebody else, I'll get happiness. So, that is why the soul gets endlessly entangled. But in Vedic culture, there is a process. Dharma, Artha, Kama. And when one finds that Kama doesn't give happiness, then one turns towards Moksha. So in this way, there is a progression. So the point here is that the system of the material world, by which there is pleasure and there is misery. There are hopes of occasional pleasure which keep us searching for pleasure, and there is a lot of misery which keeps us reminded that this is not really the place where I can get happiness. So this balance is what we need to turn towards Krishna. That's why it is not Krishna who is self-centered or sadistic, that he wants to force us to love him, or that he wants us to suffer if we don't love him. But that is the way it is, because there can be no substitute for Krishna, and there can be no substitute for the happiness that comes from love. Is this clear? Any other questions?
Sometimes talking about this completeness, this is talked in various other contexts also, where some they say that completeness means it should include some incompleteness also. So is this a valid idea, Prabhuji, that like even about talking about material worlds, this feeling of incompleteness which people have, so they say that completeness means it should include some incompleteness. So is it a correct proposition?
Okay. Interesting question. Does completeness include some incompleteness? Maybe if you read the next sections, it will come up to it. I'll just briefly mention it now. See, Aristotle had an idea of God as an unmoved mover. What does unmoved mover means? He has the idea that God has to be perfect. And if he is perfect, then he doesn't have to do anything. Because why do we do something? Because we want to achieve something. So, if he already has everything, then why does he have to do anything? And if he doesn't have to do anything, then he will not do anything. If he doesn't do anything, he is inactive. So, the whole logic, it ends in an idea of God who is perfectly inactive. He is perfect and inactive. And overall, such an idea of God is quite unattractive. Isn't it? You know, so the idea of God is like a frozen perfection. You know, what do you mean by frozen perfection? That suppose an artist is drawing a painting. So then, as the painting attains perfection, you put a line over here, put a dash over there, put a spot over here. Then the painting attains perfection. Now, one dab before it, if you put a painting brush before it, it's imperfect. If you put one extra also, it becomes imperfect. So their idea is that God has to be perfect. And for God to be perfect, if he is perfect, any change will make him imperfect. Any change will make him imperfect, and therefore there cannot be any change in God. But this idea neglects the point that there can be dynamism within perfection. So their idea is that when a person feels incomplete, that's why he acts. So in material life, people feel that if you always have a sense of completeness, then you will become unambitious. You will become inactive. So you should always have something more to achieve. Something more to achieve. That's what will keep you driving. But the point is, it doesn't just keep us driving, it keeps us unsatisfied. It keeps us craving for more. So in material life, people do activity to overcome their sense of incompleteness. I feel incomplete, so when a man, say, comes to the teenage or youth years, then he feels himself incomplete without a woman. So they have the idea of better half, isn't it? So as if the self is like a half which needs another half to complement it. It's Om Purnam Adha Purnamidam. The self is complete. Self doesn't need any another half to complete. But the point is, in material life, people feel a sense of incompleteness. So activity can be to get rid of the sense of incompleteness. That is the only activity that people know at a material level. But there can be another kind of activity which Aristotle had no idea of. That is activity to share one's completeness. When Srila Prabhupada was in Vrindavan, you know, it was not that he needed any fame to get a sense of completeness. He was completely satisfied in serving Krishna. But he wanted others to have that same sense of completeness. So his extraordinary vigor in his old age was not because of any sense of incompleteness. It was because of a desire to share the completeness. So when Krishna forms relationships in the spiritual world, that is not to overcome any sense of incompleteness. It is actually to share his completeness. And by sharing, the relishment increases more and more. So that is the activity at the spiritual level. So at the material level, there is a perverted reflection where people feel there should be some incompleteness in my life. But that incompleteness keeps them perpetually dissatisfied. And that in the spiritual realm, it is not that the devotees are dissatisfied. They are happy, but they want to do more for Krishna. They are happy and they want to do more for Krishna. So, even if Srila Prabhupada, in the Lilamrita, Satsuru Maharaj writes that, even that Srila Prabhupada, he in the early days when he was in 26 Second Avenue and before that he was in the Bowery, at that time also, he was completely happy. And he writes, he was completely successful. Because he was doing all that he could to serve Krishna. You know, he's chanting Krishna's name, offering bhoga to Krishna, speaking about Krishna to whoever was coming, writing about Krishna. So he was perfect in his relationship with Krishna. Only the world did not recognize his perfection. Srila Prabhupada was not feeling any sense of incompleteness because he did not have any followers. No, he was complete, but he wanted to share that completeness. You clear? Let's move forward. Third paragraph.
To enable them to realize the complete whole. All forms of incompleteness are experienced due to incomplete knowledge of the complete whole. The human form of life is a complete manifestation of the consciousness of the living being, and it is obtained after evolving through eightfold-like species of life in the cycle of birth and death. If in this human life of full consciousness, the living entity does not realize his completeness in relation to the complete whole, he loses the chance to realize his completeness and is again put into the evolutionary cycle by the law of material nature.
So now, how is human life special? It is special because it offers the opportunity to practice spiritual life. So, the soul's consciousness is covered by the material body it is in. And when the soul's consciousness is highly covered, then the soul cannot perceive the means to achieve eternity. Even animals want to live forever. In the sense that even animals don't want to die. But they can't perceive of any means by which they can attain eternity. In the human form, we can conceive of who I am, where I should be going, where did I come from. And these philosophical questions, we can think about them. And that's how we can make spiritual advancement. So that is why it's a complete opportunity.
See, this is like,
compare it like horizontal plane. So although the samsara chakra is vertical, but still it's horizontal because everybody in the samsara is in the realm of mortality. So why is the human life at the peak of that? In the sense, because human life can act as a takeoff point. How is it at the takeoff point? All forms are temporary. What does Prahlad Maharaj say? Adhruvam apya arthadam. Why it is arthadam? Because although the human body is also temporary like other bodies, human body gives us a developed consciousness by which we can love the eternal. The crucial transition is by the redirection of our emotions. Animals, the same soul like ours is there, but they can only love the temporal. In the human form, we can learn to love the eternal. And when we learn to love the eternal, our emotions get focused on the eternal, and then we attain the eternal. Love for the temporary. Samsara chakra goes on because of the love for the temporary. So that can be love for food, love for sex, love for life itself. So all that keeps the samsara chakra moving. But love for the eternal takes us out of the samsara chakra. And the intelligence by which one can understand that there is an eternal and that I should love the eternal, that is available only in the human form. All the other forms cover the soul so much that it cannot think about how I can love the eternal. It wants to be eternal also. The animal also wants to be eternal. But the method to be eternal, it doesn't understand. So only in the human form, we have that opportunity. That's why this human form offers the special facility. Yes, move forward. Yes.
Okay. People say, probably like, now we were discussing the point of how the material world is complete. And now the human form is also supposed to be complete. So people say that, just now as we discussed, that in animal form of life, even if one is getting frustrated, one doesn't have the required faculty and the means to identify how to end. So in one sense, the purpose is achieved at some point. Okay, now he is getting frustrated with the trying to enjoy material enjoyment. So at that point of time only, he should get that realization, whether in animal form or human form. Then how is it complete otherwise? Or even in the human form of life, how many people are realizing, even after having the experience? So how can we say or understand that it is perfect?
So, if after suffering and frustration, the realization doesn't come, then how is it perfect? It is perfect because Krishna doesn't force the realization upon us. That realization is something which we have to choose and accept. So, suffering is something which everybody experiences. Animals experience, human beings experience. Now, some human beings, they experience the suffering and they just think that my suffering is an exception and enjoyment is a norm. So, I just have to make some adjustments and I'll start enjoying. So, they think that something need to be changed by which I can enjoy. So if the desire to enjoy is so strong, then Krishna, it's like I have my imagination and that imagination confronts reality. So when there is a collision between imagination and reality, the imagination shatters. I think I will enjoy life and reality is that I can't enjoy. But then what happens is if I am too attached to my desires, then I come up with another imagination of how I will enjoy. This didn't work, let me try another way. So, we talked about inductive and deductive. So what happens is, most people are not capable of inductive analysis. That means people don't generalize from the experience of their individual suffering, that suffering is a universal feature of material existence. What they think is, yes, I suffered now, but next time I'll be successful. So that intelligence for inductive reasoning, by which one can generalize, yes, I suffered now, everybody will be suffering. And no matter what I do, I'll continue suffering. So that is something which comes through Sattva-guna. It can come through Sattva-guna, not that it comes to Nanasali, but it can come through Sattva-guna. So Sattva-guna is not there. See, in different situations, people respond in different ways to suffering. In tamoguna, the response to suffering is to go into intoxication. In rajoguna, the response to suffering is to seek deeper sense gratification. In sattvaguna, the response to suffering is reasoning, analysis, immersion in thought. And in transcendence, it is remembrance of Krishna. So, because the animals are influenced by the lower modes, so they don't get the realization. Then the question may come, how is it serving the purpose? But the point is that the soul has desired so strongly to enjoy material life that the soul now gets a body where it has the momentum of continuing on enjoying material life. So then once that momentum has got exhausted and then the soul gets a human body again, then the opportunity is there. So who created that momentum? The soul only created that momentum. That's why it's not that Krishna is creating a situation where the soul cannot get the realization. But when the soul shows that I don't want to get the realization, I just want to continue enjoying material life, no matter what happens, then Krishna gives a facility by which you can continue on. So it's Krishna's arrangement of facility for all of us, according to our desires.
Guruji, regarding this evolution, man has the choice to either go up in the evolution or down. But do the animal also have the choice? Like for example, we may say I have desires, so man go according to his desires in the evolution. But are the animals helplessly dragged towards going into that evolution cycle, or they have choice to go up and down?
Generally, do animals have the choice to go up or down? No. Animals, their free will is largely covered. And they perform primarily by instincts. So that means instinct is a form of programming. That means that instinctive behavior which is there in the body, that programs them and that covers their free will. So they go in the evolution cycle according to the karma that they had done in their previous human form. And that more or less determines how they will go. And that's why there may be variety in the amount of suffering that different animals experience also. Some animals may be born in a desert area where they have to struggle for water. And some animals may be born in a rice forested area where there's a lot of water and a lot of food. There's suffering for all of them. Because even in a forested area, if a lion is there, no deer is going to come into the mouth of the lion. So you still have to struggle and run and catch the deer. So there is that struggle for existence is there. But still, the quantity of suffering will vary depending on the past human life's karma. But overall, the soul doesn't have much control because the free will is largely covered in the animal body. And the animal body performs primarily by instinct. Now, animals also have certain learning that they do, but that's only behavioral learning. There's no moral learning that happens over there. The animal may learn, if I go over here, there's a tiger over here. That means that the presence of the tiger over there is not what it is learned by instinct, by genetics. There's acquired learning is there a little bit. And that's how animals can also be trained. In a circus, they train animals. But that training is mostly behavioral. It's not moral. This is right and this is wrong. This gives me food, so I'll take it. This will give me a stick, so I'll not do it. It's like that. So they don't have any moral learning. And evolution, the growth in spiritual evolution requires moral learning.
This purport that human form of life is a complete manifestation of the consciousness of the living entity, which is obtained after evolving through 84 lakh species of life. But we hear that after 80 lakh species of life, human form is attained. So,
see, after wandering through 8.4 million species or 84 lakh species, it is said, that is a rhetorical expression. It does not mean, the point is that it's not that the soul has to wander through every single one of the species. It's a rhetorical expression. It's just like, if you go to meet up your friend in a city like Mumbai, and you don't know where he is, and you search this place, and finally you find him, that you say, for you I searched the whole city. Now that doesn't mean that you literally went into every single corner of the city. So, within the 8.4 million species, where the soul will go, that will depend on the soul's individual karma. But this is a rhetorical explanation. The soul has to wander through 8.4 million species. That means it has to go through so many species. So 8.4 million species include the human species. Because that means I search the whole city for you. So that person, that friend's house is also in the city only. So then I found him in that city only. So like that, the human species is also within the 8.4 million species. But the point is, it is so rare. There are two points in the answer. One is that we don't have to necessarily go through all the species to come to human species. And human species also included, but we have to go through so many species to come there that the rarity or the difficulty of attaining that is indicated by this rhetorical explanation. So when I say, I searched the whole city to find you, what do I want to say? I went through so much difficulty to find you. So like that, the soul has to go through so much difficulty in labdhva sudurlavam bahusambhavante. Bahusambhavante. Many lives I went through. That's the point that we emphasized. Okay. Yes, Kiran. Then we'll come there. Come there. Okay. Did we have two mics? Okay, then. then one mic can go, it's already there, fine. Yeah,
okay. So we see that evolution, there's gradation in evolution within 84 lakh species. Till the point of human being, we see that suddenly a jump from animal consciousness to human consciousness. There is a chance that human being can go back to Godhead, but till that, there is no opportunity. What is this sudden jump? Why it happening? And it's evolution is gradual. Other thing is just that doubt comes, like, because we are human beings, how we created like that? That we only have that opportunity. Human being would like
that. So, why is there a sort of jump? Now, it's a jump in the sense that the covering on the soul is weakening. And that the verse is there, dhumena avriyate vahanir tha darshomala jay tholvena avrito garva tha tene dam avritam. So three coverings are explained over there in 3.38, that just as fire is covered by smoke, just as the child is covered by the embryo, and is just as the dhumena tha darshomala jay, the mirror is covered by dust. So basically Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains in Rasika Ranjan that these are more and more thick levels of covering. So then it takes more and more time to remove the coverings. So the leap is significant in the sense that the covering decreases substantially. So sometimes we may say that animals are also in goodness. We say a cow is in goodness, or say swan is in goodness. The point is, it's like they are in ignorance goodness. There is goodness, passion, ignorance. All animals are in ignorance. But within ignorance, there is a spectrum. So within ignorance, there is ignorance, ignorance. There is ignorance, passion, and there is ignorance, goodness. So, but the platform is ignorance. The common denominator is ignorance for all of them. Whereas, we can say human beings are in ignorance. But the human form itself has a certain level of goodness in it. So it's like, human form brings with it a certain level of understanding or a certain capacity of understanding, and that is indicative of goodness. And within that goodness, we can have goodness, 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 passion, goodness, ignorance. A certain level of goodness is there. So the leap is because the human form is created that way by Krishna to give us the facility for spiritual realization. And now, as far as the idea that, you know, we are human beings, so we have enthroned ourselves as the pinnacle of creation, that is, it's possible, but the point is that objectively also, humans have more evolved intelligence. What they use it for is different. We humans have developed languages, we have developed culture, we have developed writing skills, we have developed... there are so many ways in which humanity has developed which animals have not developed. So we have developed civilizations. So all these things indicate that humans do have a higher intelligence. So now what is it that to be used for? That is the issue. So the scriptures tell us that all this advanced human intelligence is fine. So we will see that if we don't use it for spiritual purposes, then we use language, we use culture, we use civilization, we use it all for materialistic purposes. The same purpose that animals are using it for. Clear? Yes.
Hare Krishna. Prabhuji, with reference to the evolution that we have been discussing, I have a certain doubt, to be a little basic. It seems that according to the karmas that we do, it seems that it gives us a two-time suffering. One is in the form of the subtotal consciousness that is created because of our karma at the end of our life, which lands us into a particular kind of species, which itself is a suffering. And second is the particular circumstances that are presented to us in that particular species now. Or even the third could be a visit to the hellish planets. So, one suffering is it that it creates so many different... one karma creates so many sufferings. And my second question is that if it is so, then gradually when we evolve from the animal species into the humans, so shouldn't the humans be all starting at the same platform? Because now they have finished their karma, so they would be at the same platform when they come from the evolution process.
Correct. It's a good question. So exactly, how do our karmic reactions come upon us? So they come to our...
unit for measuring karma. And you can add a 100 unit karma. After we die, some of us, it's not that everybody has to go to hell. In Kali Yuga, probably everybody may have to go, but it's not necessary that everybody has to go. So actually, people have this question sometimes, you know, Pitraloka, what does Pitraloka mean? Do all ancestors go to Pitraloka? It's not exactly like that. After death, there are three destinations. One is so, if a householder, if a person living material life and doing average dharma, means average dharmic activities he does, the normal destination that he gets is Pitraloka. If the person does above average good karma, then he will get Swargaloka. And if a person does terrible bad karma, that person will go to Naraka. So Pitraloka is not the universal destination, but it is the general destination. If people do average good karma, they go to Pitraloka. So that's why it generally assumed in Vedic culture that the ancestors go to Pitraloka. But that's not necessary. Because that is a general destination, that's why it is said that this is the Pitraloka. So the first unit of our reactions, say, let's talk about the person's doing sinful activity. That's what your centered question is. The first unit comes in. Then there we have some suffering, and then after that, we come to the new unit. So, why is this? So it's not that this 100 is multiplied 3 times and we are given 300 times. But that 100 is distributed. And why is it distributed? Because certain sufferings need to come in certain forms. It's like we have the story it's not exactly in the Mahabharata, but it is in the supplementary literature that is associated with Mahabharata, of Dhritarashtra's 100 sons being killed. Dhritarashtra asked, why did all my 100 sons die? So he said, because 100 lifetimes ago, sorry, 50 lifetimes ago, you had killed 100 birds as a hunter, 100 bird babies as a hunter. Dhritarashtra became grave and he said, if that was 50 lifetimes ago, then why did I get the reaction after 50 lifetimes? It was because you had to do punya for 50 lifetimes, by which you could get 100 sons in one lifetime. And then you got one reaction for that. So, you didn't know the story? Oh, really? Okay. So the point is that, you know, the super soul and his agents know best which karmic reaction needs to come in which way. So that's how it is distributed. So now within this also there is further distribution. See, if say this unit 2 is the amount of karma that I am supposed to get in the animal body, but that unit 2 is not necessarily delivered in one go. Within that we have prarabdha and aprarabdha. So for example, or let's consider, it's difficult for us to identify ourselves with the animal body. So let's consider the human body. So if I have a human body, then the starting body that I get, it has a certain kind of looks, it has a certain kind of intelligence level, it is born, we are born in a particular family with a particular financial level. So that starting point is what is determined by our prarabdha karma. So that unit 3 comes to us. So it's like this point of unit 1, unit 2, unit 3, clear? Now this I was going to explain in Kurva Neveha Karmani purport. So probably what I will do is, the way we are going, I'll just answer questions now and I will just highlight the point that are there in the purports. You may not be able to read the full book. That's how we are going now. But we are covering whatever is there in the book. That's the proper part of our karma, vikarma, akarma. Is my Sanchit karma or accumulated karma. So now here Parmanand, so just now, so now what is being delivered to me right now? So now I have a starting body which I got, that was my prarabdha karma. Now as I move forward in my body, I might get fever, I might get accident, I might get a financial reversal. So that is the aprarabdha karma that comes in. So aprarabdha is, if you think of this as a water tank, then the water is going out of that. And now I am doing certain actions. So those actions are creating what is called as agami karma. Agami karma is also called as kriyaman karma. It's what I am creating. So the sanchit karma is like the water tank, and the water tank, there is an outflow by water, there is outflow knob over there, and there is an inflow knob over there. So the outflow that is going on, what is getting delivered to me, is the aprarabdha that is slowly coming out. And what I am creating now, that is the agami or the kriyama. So now, in the human form that I have, so say out of this total sanchit karma, if say I had left my previous human body with the sanchit karma of this much quantity of 100, so unit 1 and unit 2 were delivered earlier to me. So now what is remaining is unit 3. Now according to the kind of desires we have and according to the kind of reactions we need to get, I may not get the unit 3 fully in this life also, or I may get it, it varies. But within this, certain karma I get at the start with the kind of body I have, and certain karma I get throughout the life. And in that way, this sanchit karma decreases. As a prarabdha comes out, it gets exhausted. But if I do further karma, I am adding to it. And that's how the agami... So this doesn't get exhausted, because while on one side it is getting depleted, on other side it is getting filled again. So when we do bhakti, what happens is, at least we stop this. We don't do any further karma. And Krishna either minimizes or eliminates the aprarabdha for us. Sometimes the aprarabdha will come a little bit. Sometimes it will just get burned up completely. That's how our karmic reactions are distributed over different lifetimes. Different lifetimes and different ways in which they come to us. Is it clear?
Yes. Koji, the pap and punya, however, they don't cancel each other. So the person will go to swarga or pitralok and will also go to narakloka, right?
Okay. The pap and punya don't cancel each other. So in general, they don't cancel each other. But there are some prescribed forms of atonement which are not exactly cancellation, but they are sort of self-chosen punishment. So we can't call it exactly cancellation, but it is a self-chosen punishment. Just like a criminal, if he voluntarily surrenders to police, then maybe the sentence is decreased. And then later on, when the sentencing of the other criminals is there, if he turns an approver and he actually participates in giving evidence and testimony in the witness box, then further his punishment may decrease. So like that, atonement doesn't cancel the bad karma with punya. So it's not that if we do some prayaschit, we are doing punya. Actually, we are choosing a voluntary suffering so that that sort of replaces the karmic suffering that we are supposed to get. Yeah.
While evolving from this animal, he will go through all the species, right? Up to the human ladder.
Not necessary. That will depend on the karma. That's what I said just now. It's rhetorical. To go through, I have searched all 8.4 million species. That's rhetorical. Whatever is required, what that means, what are the kinds of desires that that soul had to enjoy? So, according to those desires, the appropriate bodies are given to. Yes, Vijay.
Proji, you told that animals are largely covered to going up and down. One sentence you told. And also, they have to go through their karmic reaction. But in Shastra, we are seeing there some certain examples, like one is deer, that in his previous life he was a Bharat Maharaj. So he was staying near that sadhu's kutir and all. and he was meditating on his previous lives and all, how to going up and next life. Another example, we are observing as a Gajendra. In such a distress situation also, he was meditating on Lord.
A thoughtful question. I understood your question. These are animals which are practicing spiritual life, apparently. So how does that happen? Probably your batch is the most intelligent batch I have taught till now. Everything that I am going to speak before you are you are asking questions right now. Very nice. Thank you. So, the thing is, in animal life, we cannot start spiritual life, but we can continue spiritual life. In animal bodies, spiritual life cannot be started, but spiritual life can be continued. See, how does that work? That, if you look at Krishna is saying in the Bhagavad Gita that Neha Vikarvana Shosti. And Prabhupada explains that Trayate Mahato Bhayat means that one never, if one practices spiritual life, one is saved from the danger of never losing a human form. Now if you see Bharat Maharaj, he had not just started spiritual life, he had made lot of advancement. So if he had made lot of advancement, then how did he lose the human form? Not only he fell down, but he lost the human form. And then if he lost the human form, then what is the meaning of saying that the Trayate Mahato Bhayat, one is saved from great danger. So actually, here there are two principles that are conflicting. One principle is that spiritual advancement is never lost. The second principle is that whatever we are attached to, that is what we will attain. Yam yam vapi smaran bhavam. So in the case, special case of Jagat Bharat, or Bharat Maharaj rather, these two principles sort of contradict. Because he was very advanced, but he was attached to and thinking of a deer at the time of death. So according to the second law, the law of last thought, as it is sometimes called, whatever we think as the last moment, that's what we get. So that law applied on him, and he got a deer body. But the first principle was also held intact by the fact that he got a deer body, but not deer consciousness. So although he had a deer body, he had more than a human consciousness. He was not only aware that I was Bharat in my previous life, but he was also aware that spiritual advancement is the goal of life, and associating with sages is the means of making spiritual advancement. So actually, when somebody falls down, we may wonder what is it that is actually stored. And what is stored is that attraction towards Krishna. And that attraction towards Krishna was expressed even in the deer body. So similarly, Gajendra, now in his case it was not bad karma, but it was a curse. So in the Vedic culture, rishis are considered very powerful. And even we have Maharaj Raghuna saying that I'm not afraid of Indra's thunderbolt, but I'm afraid of a Brahmana sage. So we have, by the Brahmana sage, the normal spiritual evolution of Maharaj Indradyumna, he would never have lost a human body. But because of that curse, he lost the human body. But again, he did not lose human consciousness. It was cowherd because of the body that he was in. But when the right moment came, it just awoke. It just awoke and he realized, okay, this is the path that I have to follow. So that's how animals can also practice spiritual life. In fact, Jnananda Maharaj, the one sannyasi in his point, there is a very fascinating book called Animals in Krishna Consciousness. You have it? Okay, nice. So we need to have a copy of that in our library also. It's a very good book, which talks about various temples in ISKCON. For example, there's a temple in Malaysia where there was a dog. Every evening for Gaur Aarti, that dog would come. And that dog would just stand outside and look at the deities. And now normally wants a dog near a temple, so people would shoo it away. And it would go away and not barking, not no violence, just sit quietly. At a little distance away, and look. And then gradually the devotee started to say, this is a devotee dog. This is a devotee dog. So then sometimes it may happen that somebody may go to, because of some reason, a devotionally minded soul may go to a lower species, but their attraction to Krishna remains. And every day a dog would come, and one day they found a dog did not come. And then they discovered that dog had actually passed away. So the point is that even animals can exhibit some sort of religious tendencies from their previous lives. Yes, Ro. Mike. Really?
she don't mix with the opposite sex, and she stays Mangal Aarti and everything she attends. And very like with emotions she expresses cow.
Interesting. Maybe we need to get a copy of that book. Yes.
So my question is regarding the starting the spiritual life. So many times this is the talk going into the Shastra that the upper higher planetary system like Swarga Loka and above them, so they also always having desire to take birth in the Bharat Varsha and particularly on the earth to start the devotional life. So for them it's not possible to take the devotional life from there and go back to it. And either they also come under the all karmic reactions.
What is the status of the heavenly species? Heavenly planets. Yeah, the living beings who are in the heavenly planets. They are also in the human species. Well, Bhaktacharya Maharaj gave an example, which I have not seen in Shastra, but it's a reasonable example. He compares the 14 planet systems to a 14-story building in which 7 stories are above the ground and 7 stories are underground. So if you want to go out of the building, you have to come to the 7th story. Whether you are below or whether you are above. So, now, there is in the 5th canto when the cosmology is being talked about, it is described that the earthly planetary system is karma bhumi. This is where karma acts. Now, does that mean there is no karma anywhere else? Not exactly. You know, everywhere the soul is responsible for his actions. But the soul is given a greater gamut of freedom. For example, in Swarga, the demigods can enjoy with the apsaras, and that does not incur any karmic reactions. In earthly planetary system, if a person engages in sense gratification, that involves karmic reactions. So, in the heavenly planetary systems, the laws of karma are much more flexible, or rather, they allow much more freedom. In that sense, we can say that there is no karma over there. Karma bhumi is the earth. But still, the soul is responsible for his actions. Now, if Indra goes beyond boundaries and say tries to copulate with Ahalya, then he gets a curse from Gautam Rishi. So there are limits also. If Indra disrespects Durvasa Muni, then he gets defeated by the demigods. So there are actions, the principle of actions having consequences exists over there also. But not in the strict karmic sense that it is there over here. Now from the heavenly planets, can the souls advance further? Generally speaking, no. Tetam bhuktva svargalokam vishalam kshine punye martilokam vishanti. So punya takes them up and it brings them down over here. And from here they go out. But Prabhupada talks about, based on Sridhar Swami's commentary, that at the end of the kalpa, at the end of the day of Brahma rather, or at the end of life of Brahma, from Brahma's planetary system, Brahma and his devotees, his worshippers, go back to the spiritual. If they have developed the sufficient spiritual credits. But generally speaking, the idea of Indra, somebody in this Indra becoming, say, Brahma, or going upward from Swarga Loka to Tapa Loka or Jana Loka, that is not mentioned in the scriptures. So generally speaking, in the Chaitanya Bhagavat, when the demigods offer prayers to Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, they say that actually in the heavenly planets, they are not sinful. But there is so much sense gratification available within sort of dharmic limits that to focus on Krishna and his devotional service is difficult. So that's the point. That means because there is so much material enjoyment available and there is so much facility for material enjoyment also in terms of the relaxation in the laws of accountability that they get caught up in the enjoyment. And if they go beyond the limits, then they have to suffer. But in general, they can enjoy a lot over there. So going out of the material existence is generally not possible through there. Yeah.
One more thought that Prabhupada, I don't know how much it's correct, but I heard that Prabhupada told that because of so much material desire, my so many disciples will land up into the Swargaropa instead of coming back to the Godhead. And in Bhagavad Gita, so Bhagavad Gita or in Bhagavatam, Krishna claimed that if devotees having the material desire, then they will get so much enjoyment into the spiritual world and after, sorry, into the heavenly planet, and after they will come back to the my place.
My question is that, yeah? First question is regarding this. Prabhupada says, some of my devotees, disciples due to enjoyment remedy go to heavens. Krishna says that in the 6th chapter also. Tetam, no, what is that? Prapya punya kritan lokan ushitva shashuti sama shinam shmitam gehe yoga prashto bijayati. 6.41 he says that. So, the point is, if they go to heaven, from heaven they have to come back here. Prapya punya kutan lokan ushitva shashvati samaha. For a long time they stay there. And after that, they come shuchinam shrimatam gehe. In pious or wealthy families, they are born here. And yoga brashtubhya, then they continue the practice of yoga. So how, basically what is the emphasis that Krishna is doing or telling over there? That if somebody has a desire to enjoy, you will not be deprived of that enjoyment. You will get that enjoyment. And then, after you got the enjoyment, you can continue your spiritual life. But that continuing the spiritual life is after coming back to the human form again here, in the earthly planet system. So, Srila Prabhupada did not say that many of his disciples will have to go to heaven. That was more of a cautionary statement. That give up the enjoyment. And if devotees are sincere, gradually, as we keep practicing Krishna consciousness, the material enjoyment, we see its futility. And gradually the desires start decreasing. But the principle, the emphasis is that if material desires are what are troubling you in spiritual life, Krishna, okay, you take the desires, enjoy them, and then get them out of the way. Now, normally they will not get out of the way, but because a devotee has had a higher taste, the material enjoyment will slowly frustrate the devotee. And the devotee will return back to Krishna's lotus feet fast. So that is the purpose. Krishna doesn't want to sidetrack us. But Krishna wants to get rid of that which is sidetracking us. So if material, Krishna doesn't want us to go to heaven necessarily. But if we have so much material desire, then we are somehow not able to get to the realizing that it will not make us happy. Krishna says, okay, you enjoy it and then get rid of it. And then you can continue your spiritual life peacefully. So that is just Krishna's arrangement to help us deal with material desires. Is that clear?
The question is, after evolution, human form of life, after that he has to go to animal life according to his karmas. But it's like a sort of jump, not like that again. He has to again, after he getting the reactions of suffering, again he will come to the human form of life. Is it right? Because then what is the meaning of the human form of life is very rare. There is an analogy like a tortoise in the ocean.
Correct. The human form is rare in the sense that if you look at all the other species and the number of living beings in that species, it's huge. If you see, if you count the number of germs that are there, nobody has done a population census of the germs. There will be billions and billions. And every one of them is soul like us. If you look at the grass, every grass is a soul. And how many grasses are there like that? Isn't it? So, there's so much, so many souls in so many species. And if you compare the totality of all the living beings, human beings are not all that. So in that sense, human form is rare. So, labha sudurlabham idam bahusambhavante manushyam nityam arthadam apihadhira. So it says that actually although it is, the other verses, we'll come to that in the Asuryanam Tiloka Purport. Sudurlabham and Sulabham. It is very difficult to get, but it is got also, automatically got in the progression of nature. So the point is that it is rare to get, but all of us have got it. So don't lose it. Look at the totality of the number of species that are there, number of souls that are there, and human form is very rare.
We understand when one needs prasad, like anybody, like any animal or like that, so it is guaranteed that he will get the next birth as a human form, like in the sense we call it as a human gets prasad or like that. In the sense,
generally speaking, it's said that if anybody takes prasad, they will get the human form of life. But ultimately, Krishna never forces anything on anyone. So if the person has particular kind of desires, if the person is attached to this pet and the pet happens to be a dog and is thinking of the dog at the time of death, then that prasad will not go waste in the sense that some spiritual inclination will remain, but the person may get an animal body. So, there, see, when the scriptural promises are there, the scriptural promises are true. But at the same time, there are other scriptural principles also that are involved. And Krishna will arrange the harmonization balance of those principles. But in general, the point that is emphasized is giving prasad is a very valuable aid in other spiritual journey. Now, how exactly that aid will play out, that will depend on that person's desire, that person's karma. But the aid will surely be there. Okay.
Yeah. Guruji, just a small question. Just principles of Neha, Vikramana, Shosti and all, they will equally apply to people following other religions, Christianity, Islam and all. Prayate mato bhayat.
Will the principles of Nihavika Shastri apply to followers of other religions? The principle underlying is attraction to God. So if they have developed attraction to God, it doesn't matter which religious tradition they have developed. That will apply. But if somebody has just is following religion in the sense of just developing the purpose of religion is to destroy a false ego and to help us understand that our identity is beyond the body. But many times religion becomes the basis of our false ego. So if the religion is primarily for egoistic or materialistic purposes and it does not involve much attraction to Krishna or attraction to God in general, then that gain is temporary. So
that would be like Shrameva Kevalam?
Yeah, to some extent like that. I think Prabhupada does not include Karmakandis in the list of people who are practicing auspicious work. He only includes Jnanakandis and Bhaktas. Jnanis, Yogis and Bhaktas. So, if people are practicing that religion at a Karmakandi level, then the gain is not eternal. But if through that they have developed an attraction towards Christ, then that is something which will continue. That principle is beyond sectarian boundaries.
And probably one more small question. This material world can be termed as complete unit, even materially, like what's happening today in the material world on a material plane, as per the vision of materialism. That is also like a complete thing, perfect creation.
Is material world complete materially?
Because we also hear this, no, probably that God gave world to the man, but man has deteriorated it.
Yes, the material world is complete in itself in the sense that, you know, humans take oxygen, but then plants produce oxygen again. And humans give out carbon dioxide, plants take away the carbon dioxide. That means, in nature, there is a system of balancing itself. So in that sense, it's complete. And the material nature doesn't need constant intervention of Krishna for its management. Krishna has created in such a way that it is a self-managing, self-sustaining unit. So in that sense, it's materially complete, as far as its functionality is concerned. But it is incomplete if we think that it is the arena for fulfilling our desires. Then that is also inadequate. But nature has fascinating and intricate balances by which it manages itself.
Yes. Regarding human form of life, is there some animal species from that only one comes to human, or there is nothing like that?
Are there some specific species through which one comes to human form? Srila Prabhupada explains in Bhagavatam Purport that when the soul comes through the mode of goodness, the soul from the cow's body comes to the human body through the mode of goodness, like that through the monkeys in the mode of ignorance, and tiger is like that. So there are various species which are given, but I would not necessarily say that this is an inclusive list. It's not an exhaustive list. So there can, it ultimately depends on the karma of the soul. So what kind of karma that soul was supposed to go through according to his previous species, and then he comes to the human species. So there are some general patterns, but I wouldn't say that that's necessarily exhaustive. The primary factor determining it is the karma of the soul.
Another small question. Regarding the heavenly planets and the hellish planets, like that Brahmanda picture is there, in that it is mentioned that these are subtle and these are gross. So how to understand this? Higher planetary systems, like that Brahmanda picture is there, colorful, of universe, structure of universe. So okay, how do we understand it is subtle? What way it is present in this world, in one universe? Higher planetary systems, they are written it is subtle, and lower planetary systems is written cross. So how do we understand it?
How do we understand the planetary system subtle and gross? Well, firstly, that cosmology diagram is not very authoritative. With all due respects to whoever made it, you know, our understanding of cosmology is not as clear as it seems to be from that diagram. The broad patterns are fine in that, but there is much subtlety which is, needs to be further researched. That's the first point. So we should not use that particular diagram as a final authority for deciding things, because that is something which is still a matter of study going on. Now, the higher planetary systems are subtle in the sense that they are made of subtler elements. And just like Earth is a prominent element over here on Earth, our bodies are made of Earth. The higher planetary systems are made of subtler elements. And the lower planetary systems, they are made of a different set of elements. They may be called as gross, but there are some of them which are equivalent to heaven also, like Sutra is equivalent to heaven. So I'm not sure, at least in the fifth canto of cosmology which I have read, I didn't come across the specific word gross to describe the lower planetary systems, because in many ways they are almost like heaven. But maybe they are made up of a different set of elements, and that's why they are called as gross. But general principle is that there are different realms of existence, and according to the karma of the people, they have a particular kind of structural element which is primary in their bodies and primary in their environment. So that is subtler in the heavenly planet, and that may be grosser in the lower planets.
In many reincarnation cases, there is a gap between the first, the person died and he took the second birth, especially in the pilot reincarnation. There's a gap of some decades, the person pilot died and then person there. So there's a gap in how that the person remembers his previous life, because either he would be in some other species, but then he should forget his that human birth, he should remember the time between those two timings.
Sometimes when people forget their past, remember their past lives, there's a significant gap. Generally speaking, we shouldn't assume that in the time difference between, say, two human births, wherever the soul has gone, time flows at the same rate. Because time flows at different rates in different areas of the cosmos. So that's why the soul might even be in the transitional period might itself take more time also. See, the journey from one life to another life, one body to another body, that is not standard. That also depends on individual karma. So the preta body, yesterday I was telling, preta body that a soul has, how long that soul stays in the preta body, that will also vary. Nowadays nobody is for, actually to go from the preta body to pitra body, anta samskara very important, the pinda anakriya is very important. When that is not done, then it may take a longer time for the soul to go to the next place. So basically, from the way the Bhagavatam describes, the Garuda Puran talks more about what happens to the soul after that and the journey after that. But in general, the time dimension is not the standard of it. So, most of the times, many of the times when people remember their past lives, it is often because of the stimulus that they get. In James Landinger's case, the boy was, you know, the past life and the airplane pilot, it was his simulation of planes. So even in the he wrote, his mother and father, they wrote a whole book called The Soul Survivor. So for my documentary series, I got a copy of that book and went through it. The first he was just used to love trucks, and there was no abnormal behavior on his side. and one day his relative came and gave him a plane as a gift. From that time he just left all other toys, and planes became his madness. And then from that time all his dreams started, all his nightmares started, and then he started talking about his previous memories. So the point is that the soul is in one's body, then the soul goes somewhere, we don't know where, how long it will go, where it will go, and what will be the time flow in that realm. That will vary according to the soul's karma, and then it comes to the human form. In the human form, what stimulates the memory of the previous human form is some event over here, generally speaking. So that stimulus is very frequently there. And in principle, because these two forms are similar, even if the soul has gone to some other species, the experiences in that species are so dissimilar to what they are in human species. And it's so different that those memories are generally not reconnected. So even if there had been a transitional form between the human species and that other species, the similarity of the body that we have, and possibly the similarity of the circumstances that the person encounters, stimulates the memory of the previous human form from the subconscious memory. See, in the mind, the memories are stored. And if there is some stimulus, they get accessed. So in certain situations, they get accessed. So that transitional phase, because the time phase is different, because the experience is so radically different, you know, most people, practically there is no conscious memory of disembodied existence. Disembodied existence means if the soul was in between two bodies, what happened at that time? Nobody has had conscious memories of that. Very, very few cases. Generally, only in hypnotic regression some people may remember, okay, I was like this, and the in-between life states some people remember. But most of the time it's only previous human life that they remember. And maybe immediately after that something happened, they might remember for a few minutes. Because there has to be a frame of reference around which memories are evoked. So if the frame of reference is entirely different, then the memories don't get evoked. Okay? Yes.
Okay, we are done. Okay, suppose man, after he leaves the body, he goes, suppose he takes birth as a woman. So this same subtle body, the mind intelligence and false ego, it goes into the body of the woman. So why do we say that woman is less intelligent? We may say because she's emotionally weak. So, but we say in the previous life, the same intelligence and the mind was in the male's body. But now, how can we say just because accepting a female body makes the mind and intelligence weaker?
How is the woman less intelligent? This is a controversial topic even within ISKCON. What to speak of the outside world? So, let's look at it objectively. The soul is similar. So, the less intelligence cannot be at the spiritual level. The soul in the female body and soul in the male body is similar. Now, is the less intelligence in the material level? Well, we will see that many times women perform better in academics than boys. So there are many fields where women do better. So then if the less intelligence is not at the material level and less intelligence is not at the spiritual level, where is it? Primarily, it is at the interaction between matter and spirit. See, Srila Prabhupada uses the word less intelligent in the sense of misidentifying with the body. In the female form, thus, for a woman especially, practically her entire sense of self-identity comes from her body. People are attracted to women because of her body. And for a woman, in the female body, the soul's identification with the body is very strong. And in that sense, women are said to be less intelligent. So the statement that woman is less intelligent is not there directly in the Gaudiya literature. Srila Prabhupada gets it from Manusamhita. Manusamhita talks about it. And
becomes larger by chanting at a biological level.
So, Srila Prabhupada is emphasizing the point and he is using some circumstantial evidence for quoting that. But he didn't want to use that against devotee Matajis to minimize them in any way. So, the soul is the same, but the body and the self-identification are much greater. And that's why women can be said to be less intelligent. Okay, let's go to the meeting for a long time.
Guruji, this question to like about, we are talking about this heavenly planet. So, is it means there are planets who are above than the heavenly planet also? So what happened to the people who goes there, like we are talking Sine Punya Mirtuloka Vasanti, those who go to heavenly planet, they come back. What about the people, those who go higher than the heavenly planet, like Tapa Loka Janu or Loka Zalde?
What happens to residents of Teloka Janloka Tapaloka? Brihat Bhagavatamrita indicates that they have no inclinations of sense gratification. They are interested primarily in spiritual realization. So, even if we look at the fifth canto, it is only the residents of the heavenly planets who are praying that we want to be born in Bharatvarsha. Do we see the other residents praying? Generally we don't see that, especially in the top three planetary systems. I don't remember where I read this, or I heard this in a class. The understanding was that, especially those top four, above, the Triloka, Janloka, Tapaloka, Maharloka. So these four, there the souls evolve progressively upwards. They go to Brahmaloka, and from Brahmaloka they go back to the spiritual world. That's what I have, but I wouldn't necessarily bank on that because I don't remember the reference right now. Maybe I can check and tell you. But in general, at least I have not read any statement that they come back to human, to the earthly planetary system. So there they seem to be interested in spiritual culture, and they can continue their spiritual culture.
Andrew, another question regarding this last thought of the life. Like, how much a devotee is worried about remembering at the time of death to the Lord? At the same time, what decides the remembrance of Lord at a final moment of the death? Like when we see the Ajamil case, like whole life he was committing so many sinful activities, but that somehow he got this chance to chant Narayan name. So how we look at this situation?
How important is it for a devotee to remember at Krishna at the time of death? As Krishna says, it's important for us to remember. But then we have the pastime of Ramacharya also asking Varadaraj to Kanchipurana that Lord says, I will come and give you remembrance at that time. So our focus is to do our part. Krishna will do his part. Our part is that as much as possible when we are in Jagruti stage, we try to remember Krishna. And then at the time of death, we may be in Jagruti, we may be in Swapna, we may be in coma also, whatever. Krishna will lose remembrance at that time. Or it might happen suddenly. But generally what happens is we don't have to worry too much about Krishna doing his part in the relationship. We have to worry about we doing our part. So if we remember Krishna as much as possible for us in our life, then Krishna will use remembrance at that time. And regarding Ajamil, it's important to recognize that remembrance which he got when the Yamatas came did not liberate him. It gave him a second chance. So that also happened because he called out to San Narayan, and when he called out to San Narayan, then that utterance of the word Narayan reminded him of the Lord Narayan. So he realized that, oh, what can this boy Narayan do to help me at this point? I have to remember that Lord Narayan. So in that sense, he did remember Lord Narayan. His intention was not to call out Lord Narayan, but calling out the name Narayan reminded him of Narayan. And then the Vishnutas came and they gave him a second chance. That also indicates in one sense that if somebody has practiced spiritual life, Krishna comes to the rescue later. So we have to focus on just practicing spiritual life at the best that we can. Krishna will do his part. So this is just the same principle. Krishna comes to the rescue when somebody falls in. How is this related to this topic? I mean, here I would like to take question, but I think our train has not yet started only, you know. Maybe we can talk personally, don't mind. Something related with the topic. Discuss tomorrow. And let's complete some things. You know, I want to at least complete this this invocation today. This question and that question, then we'll.
Guruji, you said that generally earthly planet only we can go out of this material world, but we see examples, and that too in human form of life. So if you see examples like Gajendra or other animals, many come in Shastras, especially Gajendra I could remember.
Yeah,
he was in heavenly planets.
Another place also. So, I would say that Gajendra's example is exceptional, it's not standard. First of all, it's an animal remembering, and not only animal remembering, the Supreme Lord coming and intervening. Yeah, but the point is that it is an extraordinary situation. We can't expect that to happen in normal sadhaka's life. So, again, I will not, this is an issue under discussion, and I will not make a conclusive statement that only the human form is and earthly planet system is the only way to get out. I told you Bhakti Charma has given this example. I have not found something exactly similar in Shastra. But it seems a general principle. Now Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita that karmanu bandhi manushya loki. Some people say that refers to earthly planet system. That the karma bandhan happens only in the manushya loki, not in the earthly planet system. But I wouldn't close the case around this idea. It's possible that from other realms also soul can get liberated. There is a general rule and there are exceptions. So the general rule seems to be that the earthly planet system is the place from where people get liberated. But exceptions are always there.
Are experienced due to incomplete knowledge of the complete whole. So again, this incompleteness means the feeling of not having the happiness or the misery.
Correct.
And complete whole knowledge means knowing the purpose behind desire.
Personality of God.
Personality of God.
Because when we know
and with that the purpose.
Of course.
Yeah.
The purpose that I have to develop a relationship. Yes.
Prabhuji, there was a class by Prabhupada in temple few weeks back. So there Prabhupada mentioned that some scientists said that women have 34 ounce of brain and male have 64 ounce of brain. And later on he mentioned that that's why you will not find any big mathematician or philosopher or scientist a woman. So is it not that Prabhupada is talking even on the brain level, the brain substance level, that they are less intelligent comparatively to the male?
Yeah, I think I discussed this point yesterday. I mentioned about how Srila Prabhupada based this knowledge on the knowledge of, I think his professor was Professor Alexander Scott or somebody. He was, Prabhupada was in Scottish Church College. And in Scottish Church College, there were compulsory Bible classes. And there was a hardline Protestant Bible teacher, quite a prominent teacher. So he had this argument that women are less intelligent, that is there in Christianity also. And Prabhupada is simply quoting that. Now, subsequent research has shown that it's not true. That it's not necessary that women's brain is smaller than male's brain. I mentioned yesterday also the point that whether the smaller brain necessarily indicates a smaller intelligence. That's also a debatable issue. Because there are people with no brain and having a lot of intelligence. They're exceptional cases, but they are there. So the important point is that there is a principle that comes from Shabda. Illustrate the principle from Shabda, sometimes an example or argument can be given from Pratyaksha and Anuman. And Pratyaksha and Anuman, by definition, are never conclusive. They keep changing. So by Pratyaksha and Anuman, whatever argument we may give, if later on it is turned out to be inadequate or incorrect, then it needs to be abandoned. But the principle from Shabda needs to be established using other arguments. So the example for this is that suppose if we are going for a preaching program and we are going in a vehicle. Now when you are going in a vehicle to the preaching program, if the vehicle breaks down on the way, then we have two alternatives. One is fix the vehicle, second is change the vehicle. Our purpose remains the same. The purpose is to go for the program. But while going for the program, the vehicle is a tool. And if the tool breaks down, either repair it or replace it. Two alternatives are there. Similarly, our goal is to help people develop faith in Shabda. And to help them develop faith in Shabda, the knowledge from Pratyaksha and Anuman is like the vehicle. So we use that as a vehicle to help people develop faith in Shabda. Because people don't have directly faith in Shabda. They have faith in, like if you quote some scientific research like this, people will have some faith. So we quote this. But then the nature of Pratyaksha and Anuman is that it can break down. So when it breaks down, what do? Either repair it or replace it. That means find out some other research which continues to support what we want to say. Or if you can't find that, then use some other line of argument. So that particular line of argument that Srila Prabhupada used, that was useful based on the research that was available at that time. The current research doesn't support that point. And the second point about women not being among prominent scientists or mathematicians, well, the feminists have a very strong counter argument. That is because we have never been given chances. Give us chance and we will become better than you. And they will argue like that because now women are becoming successful in many fields. The point is not whether women can become. The point is whether women should become. No, we are not doubting their capacity to become. We are doubting the desirability. This is a big issue. But the point is, you know, women have a, according to their psychophysical nature, they are best suited to be mothers. And when they start taking up other roles in society, nobody can substitute the role of mothers that they take. And then, what happens when there is nobody to care for the children? The whole next generation gets spoiled. And in the West, it has been a consistently documented statistic that children who get into addictions, drugs, violence, during their teenage years, all of them, then they did not have proper motherly attention and love in their childhood. So, we don't have to necessarily impose a point that women can't do it. That will invoke their rebellious spirit. But the point is, that is it necessarily desirable for them? Now, there was a survey of 25 Hollywood superstar women. And they were asked, do you miss anything in your life? All of them said, we miss being a mother. Because you know, their career just didn't allow them that time. So for a woman, the joy that comes by being a mother, caring for a child, nothing else substitutes for that. So the current society, it is practically in the name of giving independence to women, is making women into a copycat of men. That means, you know, whatever men can do, we can also do that. Well, you can do that, but you are not happy. The children are not happy by that. So we are not doubting the capability of women to do that. Maybe they can do it, maybe they can't do it. Maybe they will be, it's possible that they may do it if they are determined. But the point is it desirable for them to do it? Women is a big issue to discuss. But our point is not that they are incapable of doing it. Our point is that it may not be the best way for them to be happy. It may not be the best way for the future generations to grow up. So when society glamorizes a career, then women naturally feel, why should we not have a career? But if we had a social culture where motherhood is valued, then women would naturally want to be mothers. Now the current culture is, if a man goes for a party with his wife and some other class, so what do you do? She says, I'm a housewife. Oh, you're only a housewife? You don't do anything more? So housewife is something which is like a look down upon. So we just can't force women into a stereotype. You know, you have to be a housewife, you have to be a mother. We have to create a social culture where motherhood is valued and recognized. And then women will naturally, organically grow towards that level.
My question is that according to Yuga, Satya Yuga, Treta Yuga, Dwapara Yuga, human consciousness going down. So these all things are affecting to the higher planet systems, or that is only for the earthly planet?
Generally they don't affect the higher planet system because Kali is also a devata. And as a devata, he can accept, he can influence manavas. He cannot influence other devatas. So now there may be some effects in the sense that people don't perform on the earth, people don't perform yajna. So devatas don't come here. In that sense, there may be some change in the dynamic of interaction between earthly and heavenly planet systems. But Kali itself does not influence heavens. Because from the point of view of their time flow, Kali is just a small time phase for them. For us it's long, but for them it's small. So Kali Yuga in and of itself doesn't influence them. Kali does not have his jurisdiction over them. Because they are also like his equals. Kali is a devata, they are also devatas. Yeah, I know about that incident, but I wouldn't say that is not exactly a Shastric statement. No, he's saying that Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur once said that looking at the moon, oh, Kali Yuga is also so degraded on the moon. So, you know, generally speaking, these are anecdotal incidents. Anecdotal means somebody has said it to somebody. And from what I know, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj did not include it in his Sant Vaibhav. That is, I have not read it there. So, anecdotal incidents, I am not sure how much value we can give. So, you know, even now, for example, even in Prabhupada Leela, I am one of the elders who back to Godhead. So, whenever if somebody quotes any pastime of Srila Prabhupada, then we check what is the reference for this pastime. Because many devotees can say many things. We are not saying that devotees are necessarily concocting pastimes. But the point is, for something to have authority, there has to be multiple corroboration. So, if there is not multiple corroboration, then we are not saying that it is false, but maybe it doesn't have enough authenticity published in Back to Godhead. Generally, anecdotal incidents have to be taken with a little bit of caution, because anecdotal incidents are, after all, individual memories, and memories are fallible. Memories are not perfect. You may not remember everything, but we don't have an intention to cheat. But there's a famous example of Hayagriva Prabhu writes in Hare Krishna Explosion that he spent months and months together editing Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita translations. But Jayadeva Maharaj shows that actually, if you look at Srila Prabhupada's schedule, where Srila Prabhupada was for how long, and where Hayagriva Prabhu was at that time, it's not possible that Prabhupada could have spent months with him. For him, that association of Prabhupada was so precious that it might have seemed like months for him. So he's saying, I respect Hayagriva Prabhu as a person, but we can't say that his memory is perfect. So anecdotal incidents have to be taken with caution. So in general, when we write biographies, so in fact now there is a proposal going on that Prabhupada Leela also we need to categorize. Like what is said in Leela Amrit and what is said by other devotees. Leela Amrit is authorized biography. Other devotees may have their individual memories. Their individual memories are different. If you look at Miracle on Second Avenue, right in the beginning only Mukunda Maharaj writes that I respect what Chaturma said in Leela Amrit, but I am telling from the story from my point of view as I recollect it. And there are some small, not major differences, but there are small details, differences in the details of certain stories. So memories in general are not infallible. And that's why we need to take anecdotal incidents with a little bit of caution. Yeah.
Small confirmation. What you said is when we are driving, means when we are trying to go out program, the car fails, we need to set it up or go to them. But our purpose will not change. In the same way, where this quoting, women are less intelligent in the scripture, it is a scriptural law. But Manusamhita, Manusamhita, you are telling. So when it is scriptural law, it has to be true. Maybe the brain substance is more or less, or intelligence is more or less. So we need to take it that way, or in this note, means telling that women are less intelligent, they are fit at this place. So for that purpose it is told, or whether really that is there. So how we need to take the injunction?
First of all, now is the point that when women are less intelligent, is that an absolute principle? The samhitas, especially the law books, are not absolute. The law books come in the category of smriti, and one samhita is not the only smriti. There are many other smritis. There are many other sages also who have given their smritis, shastras. And Manusmriti is more popular. But Srila Prabhupada took some points from Manusmriti, but there are many points which Srila Prabhupada never took from Manusmriti. Manusmriti seems to be quite rigid about caste system. In terms of following of caste rules. And Prabhupada did not implement all that. There is much in Manusmriti that is not applicable. For example, Manusmriti says that there is no creature in all the 14 worlds as inauspicious as a widow. Prabhupada did not treat his widow disciples like that. Prabhupada did not treat even his own sister like that. His sister was not a widow, I'm sorry. But there are other interactions where Prabhupada never treated people like that. So, the Manusmriti, it has its authority. But it does not have universal absolute authority. And anyway, if you see, in our Gaudiya literature, Manusmriti does not figure as a prominent book. Occasionally some acharyas may have quoted from it, but Bhaktisiddhanta Sutta also doesn't quote much from Manusmriti. So the Smritis are, and it is in Manusmriti only it is said that, what is that rule? That if there is a rule given, but if a body of Brahmana, something like 12 Brahmana or something like that, they come together and they feel that a particular injunction is not applicable at a particular point, it should not be applied. So Manusmriti itself says that it is not absolute. That's why I don't think we have to absolutize that statement. So let's quickly complete reading this purport. Or maybe we don't have to read the purport, you can read it. I'll quickly, because we have more or less stated the points. So we discuss how human form offers complete facility. Now sense gratification promises completeness, but it never delivers completeness. It makes us feel that yes, if I do this, I'll become happy. But when I do this, I don't become happy, or I become temporarily happy, but after that the craving increases more and more. That's why it's illusory. It promises, but it doesn't deliver. And then Srila Prabhupada talks about, okay, if you want completeness, that completeness will come at a spiritual level. That is by the practice of devotional service. So, what that devotional service is and how it is to be practiced, Srila Prabhupada will elaborate that in the future verses. But at this point, this verse has talked about, I talked about Tattvatraya, Ishvara, Jagat, Jagdish and Jiva. So it has talked about how Jagdish is complete, it has talked about how Jagat is complete for its purpose, and now it is talking about how the Jiva can attain completeness. How, if the Jiva pursues the path of sense gratification, it will have perpetual incompleteness. But if he follows the path of devotional service, then he can achieve completeness. Thank you very much. Shri Isha Upanishad ki jai. Shri Prabhupada ki jai. What happened?